Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. That's like that. Check, check. All right, so I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network, same as always. Noon to Eastern Time. LRN.FM, LibertyRadioNetwork.com. I like that better. It forwards on, whatever, same difference. Today's show, Sheldon Richman, is going to be back on the show to talk about the Paris thing. Well, he wrote about it, and he's smart, and I like asking him stuff, so there you go. Sheldon Richman, back on the show. And then Ken Silverstein, been a while since I spoke with him. Here he is writing about the corruption of the Clintons. Great piece today at Harper's. Just the beginning of some brand new truths being revealed about the Clintons and their money and their corruption. Yeah. Good times. All right. Tons of stuff to talk about, obviously, today. And God knows what order. Oh, I should say, I'm still kind of holding out for Trevor Tim. I'm hoping he can come on to talk about his great article that he wrote about the Republicans and the Russians. Boy, this world, what a crazy place. Anyway, I want to start with the American domestic police state news today. Get to the wars and the rest of the show in a minute. But I wanted you all to see this. And, you know, as far as I know, this is the first time this has ever been calculated. If, you know, it may have been like this all along. But between 1989 and 2010, U.S. attorneys seized an estimated $12.6 billion in asset forfeiture cases. The growth rate during that time averaged 19.4% annually. In 2010 alone, the value of assets seized grew by 52.8% from 2009 and was six times greater than the total for 1989. I guess there's my answer question answered right there. My answer questioned that too. Then by 2014, that number had ballooned to roughly $4.5 billion for the year, making this 35% of the entire number of assets collected from 89 to 2010 in a single year. According to the FBI, the total amount of goods stolen by criminals in 2014 burglary offenses suffered an estimated $3.9 billion in property losses. This means that the police are now taking more assets than the criminals. Ah, but see, you're begging the question right there. Ah, proper use of the term begging the question alert. You have your assumption baked right into your premise there, your conclusion that you've assumed that somehow police are separate from criminals, but they're not. Welcome to libertarianism. Police are criminals. They already were. They still would be even without civil asset forfeiture. That just makes it really blatant so that regular people can understand it. Wow, I'm not a libertarian, but that looks like stealing to me, they say. There you go. They robbed the American people of more money than all the private criminals in the whole country combined. Your protectors. Your security force. All right, now, remember the case of the kid that was tased and eventually shot on the side of the road for saying, "Hey, am I being detained?" For flexing his rights just a little bitty bit. Oh, we got a couple of more like that. This young girl is lucky to be alive, 18-year-old girl, celebrating her high school graduation. In November? I missed something here. Oh, no, this is the lawsuit. It's kicking in. This happened last year. California teen sues cop who threw her face first to the ground hours after she graduated high school, They're having a party at their house. The cops come up, start harassing, I think it's her sister, in the front yard. And angrily trying to pull the young girl out of the car. This girl comes out and says, hey, you can't do that. We have rights. You're on our property. So he beat the crap out of her. Grabbed her by the neck. An 18-year-old girl, they say, 5 foot tall. 115 pounds. Grabbed her by the neck, slammed her face first into the driveway. Because what was her quote? You can't touch me. We have rights. We have rights. That's like saying I'm seasoned beef to a Rottweiler. And you can see at therawstory.com what she looked like after the cop dealt his vengeance upon her for daring to defy him. It really is a miracle, isn't it, that he didn't pull out his gun and just put a bullet right through her brain. Of course, he'd be in exactly the same amount of trouble that he's in now, which is none. And in fact, this girl is facing a year in prison for assaulting the police officer. How many of you believe that this little girl assaulted the police officer? How many of you believe that the court will believe, with and without ironic quotes? Two different answers, right? How many of you think that the court will pretend to believe the cop? Yeah, see. This man's dead. Cops came to his house, said, we're looking to arrest this guy. The guy said, he's not here. And they said, let us come inside and search his house. And he said, no. Come back with a search warrant. So they kicked in the door, got on top of him, beat the crap out of him, sprayed mace in his face, and then they shot him to death. The unarmed father of three, described as a, quote, hard-working, very loving family man. When Livingston attempted to remove the taser from the hands of the officer who was shocking him, the deputies executing him, claiming he got a hold of their weapon. Tasers are said to be non-lethal, yet cops evidently feared for their lives at the mere prospect of one of their victims may possibly turn it on them. It'll be good enough to get away with it. I guarantee you 100%. As it turns out, the deputies were looking for a man who no longer lives in the home. Some really great detective work there. And a man is dead. And why did they murder him? Class. Because he tried to exercise his rights that he mistakenly thought he had, if not as a human being, as an American. But nope, you're not free. That was all a lie. And guess what? For most of the American population, this applies. It's the same government that you love so much, that you keep cheering your permission for its very worst crimes, that does these things to you, to your friends, to your neighbors. It's the very same one. Well, I love it when the government persecutes people I don't like. It's just when they persecute people I do like, I start to object. But, yeah, I would plead with you to begin withholding some of your love from the state until it starts murdering a few fewer of your friends and neighbors, maybe a little.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, so one more on the domestic police state here. It's an article in Texas Monthly. I was really glad to see this, man. TexasMonthly.com. Who can get away with jaywalking? And the writer says he was in downtown Austin. He was in a hurry. He crossed the road where he goddamn felt like it. Because why wouldn't he? He's a grown adult. He can see whether there's a truck coming or not. Anyway, so he crosses the street. It's no big deal. The next day, he sees the video of these young black guys getting the crap beat out of them by the meanest gangsters downtown, the APD. And for the pretended offense of jaywalking. And when the defense's story here, which is obviously correct and truthful because he couldn't make it up, they were on the other side. There's no traffic. The light's red. And they see the armed goons standing on the corner, look right at them and say, hey, is it okay if we cross? The cops shrug. So they cross. And then one of them says to the other something about, we up out of this bitch or something. And the cop says, what did you say to me? And goes over there and starts beating their ass on the charge of walking against the light downtown in the middle of the night where you can see for a mile coming and there's nobody coming. They're at Red River and 6th Street. And you can clearly see past the freeway from there. I can't even believe that jaywalking is a crime. Like maybe if you're under the age of 12 or something, you better not. But for grown adults, just don't step out in front of cars. You know. But otherwise, go ahead. What the hell is this, Russia? Seriously. That's even a thing? Jaywalking? As some offense against the state? And anyway, the writer of this article, Dan Solomon, here in the Texas Monthly, says, you know, I can't help but notice that the young guy getting choked, the hand around his throat at Round Rock High School, black, and Sandra Bland, arrested, and ultimately, you know, I don't know, I guess killed herself, I don't know, but under circumstances where she sure as hell shouldn't have even been there at all in the third day of her captivity. Over nothing. Over refusing to put out a cigarette in her own car. Which the cop has no right to insist on in the first place. When he pulled her over for pulling over. When he sped up behind her. And then he says, oh, you pulled over without your signal on. Yeah, she was black too. And the cops in Texas, they suck. They're mean. Especially the Williamson County Sheriffs. Those guys are murderers, dude. Those guys are drug dealers. Those guys are dangerous. They are a law unto themselves. They always have been. But the rest of them too. Everybody knows that. And every one of the cops knows that it's easier to get away with picking on blacks. So that's who they pick on. That's who has to worry about getting beat down in the middle of the night. Apparently, the actor from the Transformers got in a confrontation with a cop and got arrested over public drunkenness, another bogus charge, where they initiated the encounter with him for what? Jaywalking. And the guy got loud and got in the cop's face. And the cop claimed that he was sort of trying to intimidate and threaten someone else on the scene, an innocent bystander or something. Who knows about the cop's story? Anyway, the cop didn't beat the crap out of the Transformers actor, who's white, took him to jail, which is ridiculous enough, but didn't grab him by the throat, didn't smash his face into a brick wall and, you know, knee him in the ribs 10 times. And anyway, so you're not black, but you hear black people complaining about police brutality all the time. That's because they're suffering it all the time. And really, the new invention of our modern era is that a lot of times whites do get it as bad as blacks, although not as often on camera these days, not in such high-profile ways. Although, that's not true. The kid that got murdered over the pot in the fast food parking lot, they cleared the cop and then released the footage of the cop clearly in no danger whatsoever, murdering the kid, firing through the side window of the car, when he was the one who ran up to try to get in the way of the car in the first place. But anyway, it's a lawless police state, and you can't really have a lawless police state that's not a totalitarian one, or at least, you know, arbitrary. Maybe they don't dictate to you how many children you're allowed to have yet, or these kinds of things, but clearly they can kill you at any time and get away with it. They could kill your dad and just go, what? What are you going to do about it? And then the answer is nothing. You can't do nothing about it all because there's no rule of law. There's no justice system. It's a rule of men, just like in the old world. The most powerful and the most corrupt gangsters seize the power and use it against everybody else. All the marble statues and all the pretty parchments is just an illusion. Always has been. Anyway, it's nice to see that in the Texas Monthly. Hey, check it out, guys. It's almost as though there is no law which actually restrains the authority of the state charged with enforcing it. It ain't just that they can run red lights when you can't. It's that they can commit murder. They can commit rape. They can do anything. As long as they're on the clock. And they got sovereign immunity. Anyway, that was that whole other segment, wasn't it? Anyway, good article, man. Who can get away with jaywalking? Certainly not black people. Maybe white people. That's the answer. Mexicans, hope you're light skinned. Try to stay out of the sun, you know. Get yourself in even worse trouble there. Anyway, the guy was just talking about where they kicked in his door and murdered him because they were searching for a guy that had every reason to believe was not there. But that this guy told them to go to hell, he was white. Politically powerless looking type. But, anyway. You know, Sean King, I actually didn't get a chance to read the article, but the Black Lives Matter activist Sean King put out a link on Twitter yesterday to an article he had written for the New York Post where they did the math and he said a cop right now is as likely to be convicted of murdering an American as a white was likely to be convicted for lynching a black in 1892 by an all-white jury. That's what he said. By an all-white jury in 1892. In other words, total impunity. Total impunity for our modern KKK lynch mob police. And hell, even in the few cases where the DAs try to charge them, if the feds don't intervene, the juries do. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them.
and, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm sorry the website is still messed up. There's a dude that's working on it, supposed to fix it. Should be good soon. I got more than 20-something interviews, you know, in queue somewhere, supposedly, that will be published at some point. So, be patient. Anyway, live show goes on. Archives keep getting recorded. Our first guest today is our friend Sheldon Richman from SheldonRichman.com. Welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Good to be with you again.
Whoa, I got you turned up way too loud here. Good. Yeah, it's been so long since we've spoken. Hey, you wrote this article. It's called How to Respond to the Paris Attacks. So, how should we respond to the Paris Attacks?
I guess I could have called it How Not to Respond.
Yeah, well, okay. What should we not do? You want to start there? That's fine, too.
Well, we shouldn't, maybe it would be quicker to say how we should. Get the hell out of the Middle East.
Yeah,
and
respect
civil liberties at home. Next question.
Yeah, okay. The next question is, but. Come on. Bad guys. Terror, fear, strike, and kill civilians.
Well, look, as you have pointed out in recent days and in recent years, actually not so recent years anymore, this has been going on quite a long time. And as your guests have been pointing out over the last few days, especially, but again, routinely, this is not what happened in Paris. Was not a bolt out of the blue. It's always looked at that way. Robert Fisk had a very good piece the other day in The Independent. They got picked up in a few places. I guess I found it at Counterpunch, where he says, whenever something like, Paris happens or some big spectacular act of terrorism in the West, doesn't happen when it's, you know, something in Beirut, or even when a Russian airliner is down, because I guess the Russians are part of the other also. But anytime it's one of us, one of our cities that is a victim, the memory banks get wiped clean. So we forget anything that happened the day before, not to mention weeks and years before, or even a century before. So, at least as far as the U.S. media is concerned, there's very little discussion of how the U.S.-led NATO coalition, which of course includes France, has been pounding areas in Iraq and Syria for quite a while now, a year and a half. France has specifically moved into Syria with air power since September. And so this is, this is not a bolt out of the blue. Terrorism, an article, my next article is probably going to be, are terrorists madmen? And by that I mean, are terrorists irrational? And by that I mean, are terrorists, is their conduct unrelated to the means ends framework that we understand as human action? And the answer is clearly no.
But you're just saying surrender to the bad guys.
Well, you want to cut to the chase, I see. No, I don't want to surrender to anybody. I want us to defend what liberties we have left and expand them rather than let them shrink anymore. We're on a path to shrinking our liberties because war, it's a cliche now, but it's true. I mean, that's why cliches tend to be true, because they get repeated so often, because they tend to have some truth value. War is the health of the state. If we intensify the war in Syria and Iraq and the Middle East generally, our liberties will suffer. And one way they will suffer is that this will provoke new terrorist attacks, which are against civilians almost by definition, I'd say. And I don't justify them. I don't think it's immoral to go and kill just people who are going about their business, walking down the street or sitting in a concert or a cafe. That's immoral. It's evil. That we shouldn't have to even have to say that, but of course we do have to say it. But nevertheless, it's an inevitable, as inevitable as things can be in human affairs, consequence of the West, the U.S., making war on Arab and Muslim populations in the Middle East. And when that inevitable response occurs, the governments will crack down. And it will seem plausible to most people that it cracked down, that they cracked down, because they're going to say, please help us, do something, which is no coincidence, because I think the planners understand that that will be a response. Now, I'm not saying that's the reason they make war in the Middle East, so that there'd be terrorism, so that they can expand government. I don't know that that's how they think about it, but that is certainly a consequence. We know this from the great history written by Robert Higgs, and it's not surrender at all.
All right, well, so what about this now? I think probably you could go back 3 years, 4 years, 4.5 years maybe even, certainly in the last 3 or 4, you could find interviews of the two of us talking about the Syria situation and talking about how with this unbelievable policy of our government being willing to, you know, and along with NATO and the GCC, willing to back the American people's enemies as long as they're attacking Assad in the form of the al-Nusra Front and whatever. I bet you we could find in those interviews where we predicted these kind of consequences. Thousands, I know that I've been saying on the show, I assume it must have been part of the discussions with you over this topic over the last few years too, that there are thousands of Europeans going to Syria to fight against Assad, and at least scores, if not hundreds, of Americans. And we know that our government's attitude is, oh, they're the good guys fighting against Assad, so they're not even trying to really keep track of who these guys might be. And or if they are, they're doing a half-assed job of it. And so at the time that bin Laden was killed, you know, Al-Qaeda, core Al-Qaeda, basically had been reduced to almost nothing. But that was 4 years ago. And Obama might as well have been the cartoon Islamic terrorist out of the right-wing ridiculous theories about him, to the degree to which he has built up the Al-Qaeda forces across North Africa and the Middle East. And, of course, it's because he thinks he's smart and getting American goals accomplished and whatever, not because he's a Muslim terrorist. That was a joke. But point being, he's done more for Al-Qaeda even than George W. Bush has done. Had done for Al-Qaeda. And so maybe, Sheldon, the question now is, what about now? Maybe what you're saying made sense a few years ago, but now Obama's been so successful at building Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State into such giant movements with tens of thousands of members that could be turned against the West and have motive to try to keep attacking us to draw us further in. What are we supposed to do about those guys?
Well, don't give them what they ask for. I listened to your interview with Robert Pape the other day, and you know, he's very good, but I like you, disagree with what he's recommending, which is that we sort of continue on doing what we're doing. He doesn't want some big all-out war, because that's what the ISIS apparently would like, to have the U.S. pour troops in there, which would help radicalize more Sunnis. So he wants the sort of middle position that Obama's taken. In fact, he praised Obama. But I asked the same question you asked him. You know, even if in some very abstract way that was a good idea, what makes you think, what makes anyone think that the guys in charge, Obama all the way down, know what the hell they're doing or will carry it out? I mean, that's the Nirvana fallacy we talk about in economics, right? Where you propose some ideal solution and say, hey, this is, you know, this ideal solution is better than any real world solution you can come up with. Yeah, great. Except you're never going to get the ideal solution. So we have to choose among realistic solutions, things that are actually on the menu. That's not on the menu. So that's the answer. I don't believe that if we were to declare a Ron Paulian, not a Rand Paulian, but a Ron Paulian foreign policy today and withdrew all troops and all special ops and diplomats and everything else from the Middle East, I don't believe that the toothpaste would thereby return to the tube. You know, it's out. There are people who have scores to settle. So I don't want to make this, I don't make this naive promise that if we just do, you know, what I'm recommending, all will be well. And we're an open society, fairly open. And so therefore there are always going to be soft targets. But I believe it will cut down the chances, minimize the chances, and make things safer than they would be by any other path.
All right, hold it right there. Let's take this break, and we'll be right back.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each.
Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. Talking with the great Sheldon Richman. Donate $100 to the show. I'll send you one of his books. Your Money or Your Life Against the Income Tax. We're talking about what to do, what the government should or should not do about the threat of the Islamic State in our post-Paris attack era that we now live in. And, Sheldon, you got cut off by the break there and everything, so I want to let you go ahead and say you were saying that you're not saying that if America adopts a non-interventionist foreign policy that the terrorism problem will just dry up and go away. What exactly is it you're saying then again?
Well, not overnight it won't. Because, look, the U.S. has been at this a long time, very long time, pre-9/11. Look, pre-Gulf War I, therefore pre the 90s when Clinton was starving Iraqi kids and bombing in the north and the south because of the no-fly zones. And not permitting their infrastructure to get rebuilt so that people could have clean water and whatnot. It goes way back. Support for Israel goes very far back, and that means oppression of the Palestinians and refusal to, either keep hands off or lean on Israel to deal fairly with the victims of occupation. So you have scores, people will want to settle scores, and they're not, I don't believe everyone's going to say, everybody over there who wishes ill to Americans is going to say, okay, they've adopted Ron Paul's foreign policy program, and they're pulling out, so let's just forget about that now. There'll be a few people who might want to still do something. So I'm not making any kind of promise. I think it would be naive to just say everything will be fine if we make this declaration and actually begin to implement it. But I think we would, first of all, we won't stimulate new animosity by killing kids and bombing hospitals and wiping out wedding parties and this kind of stuff that, tends to make people pretty pissed off. If this was happening in the United States, I think we'd see a lot of anger at whoever was doing this. Well, it happens over there, almost routinely, and I hesitate to even put the word almost in there. Innocents are getting killed all the time, and we act, we don't pay any attention to it. I mean, we meaning just the general hoi polloi. It's not our business. It's like it's not our business, especially if it's being done by drone, where Americans are not at risk because they're sitting in Nevada, right, under some mountain or something, playing a video game essentially. But people are dying over there and living with the fear. Even if they're not dying or getting injured, they live every day with the fear that they could be next. That's going to make people mad. So if we stop that, at least we stop producing new people with grievances. And we can begin to reverse it. I would do think, I agree with what Justin Raimondo wrote this week and also what Andrew Bacevich has written. We need to turn our attention to our society, keeping ourselves safe, not by violating civil liberties, of course, but that's where the concentration should be. And I'd go a step further, and not that I think this is going to get adopted anytime soon. We need to begin to privatize and decentralize security. Property owners have the greatest stake in keeping their assets, their factories, their movie theaters, and et cetera, their airlines, their airports safe. And I would move security from a bumbling centralized bureaucracy, namely the U.S. government, or even the state governments, I would move that down toward the property owners and let them network with each other and have entrepreneurship come to the service of keeping the American society safe. And otherwise, leave the Middle East alone.
Well, and people got to understand, too, that what you're talking about is privatization, not quote-unquote privatization, which is spelled entirely different. It has ironic quotes around it, and that's the one where government hires a private company to carry out the government business. Right. That's not what you're saying. You're talking about getting government out of it and letting the owners themselves have to do the hiring.
Competitive privatization. I want competitive privatization.
Right.
Not just government contracting out for monopoly.
It should be like one with an S and one with a Z or some kind of thing so that people can tell the difference between that. Because even libertarians get caught up not being able to differentiate. Oh, privately run prison. That sounds efficient. Don't! And miss the point about all the horrible, perverse incentives that come baked into a fascist arrangement like that. But
I guess we need to coin a word like competitivization.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
We don't want just private management.
You say everybody, this guy, Richmond, is a genius. I like hanging around with you, man. You're smart. All right, but now there's the political problem of, we see, you know, Obama pulled the last tens of thousands of troops out of Iraq on Bush's time scale because the Iraqis kicked us out, the faction that we helped win, the war there kicked us out. And it doesn't matter that he escalated the entire surge war in Afghanistan and then the entire drone wars in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, the regime change in Libya, the support for the Al-Qaeda guys in Syria, just like the Republican Party wanted him to do. None of that counts. Obama has shown weakness. Obama is peacenik. Obama is Ron Paul, and that's why we have an Islamic State, because Obama reduced America's military footprint in the Middle East the slightest bit, and then look, a bad thing happened. Lesson, can never leave anywhere again. And then we see that playing out. Obama announced in October on the 15th that, oh yeah, by the way, we're staying in Afghanistan forever, because I'll be damned if I'm going to let them say that about Afghanistan too. So the 10,000 troops are staying indefinitely, and special forces too, et cetera. So how are we ever supposed to do? I mean, I guess if it was Ron Paul, he would say, I don't give a damn about your argument. I'm right, and I'm still doing it anyway. But no Democrat is ever going to get us out of there as long as the right is going to argue that every bad thing happens whenever they withdraw the slightest bit is, you know, got the perverse cause-effect relationship there. So what are we going to do?
Well, you know, even if at first glance you like that strategy, you quickly realize it's a loser because you'd have to then be everywhere because the idea is, you can't let them have safe harbor in Afghanistan. Well, fine. So they move somewhere else. Now you got to be there. Then they move somewhere else. Then you got to be there. Before you know it, you need a military, and this would be unbelievably expensive. If there was no other argument against it, this should be decisive. We'd have to occupy the world. You literally, because they're going to be wherever you're not, so there can't be a place where you're not. Therefore, we'll have to have a huge military. I don't know, are there enough people of military age, even if you had conscription? I don't think there are. Is there enough money? Are you going to, are the people who want this going to want to cut everything else out of the budget? I mean, I'm all for cutting the budget to zero, but they want to seem to put it all into the military. This is something that Rand Paul hit Rubio on him. In just terms of spending $1 trillion. So it's obviously not feasible. You know, the people you're aiming against are a moving target. If they can't be one place, they'll be another place. And we've seen this, right? Bush went into Afghanistan on the grounds that they had given safe harbor, the Taliban had given safe harbor to Al-Qaeda. We had to go. Great. So they moved and spread and metastasized and mutated, and they did all those things. And now they're everywhere, including Yemen, including Africa. History has already told us that's a bad plan. So what else do we need? You know, the other thing is I thought there was a great piece in the op-ed page of the New York Times back on November 16th by Olivier Roy, called "The Attacks in Paris Reveal the Strategic Limits of ISIS." People should look this up. But one of the things a woman points out in this is that all the people who say they're fighting ISIS, almost all of them have different agendas, right? You talk about the confused agenda of the U.S. Is it against ISIS or is it against Assad and Iran? Some depends on where you're standing, right? If you're on one side of the old Sykes-Picot line, we're against ISIS. If you're on the other side of the old Sykes-Picot line, we seem to be against Assad, which benefits ISIS. But the Turks aren't on the same page. They hate the Kurds more, and they're supposedly our best partner. They hate the Kurds more than they hate ISIS. The Saudis don't seem to be against radical Islamists or jihadis or whatever term we want to use. They want to get Assad. The Shiites don't want to help the Sunnis, especially in Iraq. And so nobody's even on the same page. How does that add up to a coherent strategy? And that's not going to change anytime soon. So even on these sort of more practical considerations.
Well, yeah, I mean, if they were going to do it, really make killing ISIS their priority, they'd have to completely abandon their allies, Israel, Turkey, Saudi, and the Gulf states, and realign with Russia and the Iranian crescent and say, like, that's right. We're Hezbollah's Air Force killing these guys.
When ISIS was going against
not that I'm recommending Palmyra, that. I'm just saying that would be coherent, right?
Right. Patrick Coburn has pointed out that when ISIS was going to conquer Palmyra, the U.S. wouldn't bomb because that would have been helping Assad's forces.
Right.
So apparently they held back. So nobody even knows what side anybody's on, including the United States.
Well, and people are saying, well, maybe there will be a change now after Paris, but there wouldn't a change after Mosul? And we were joking about this right in 2014. They're like, okay, now that they've declared a caliphate, now they're going to have to stop the war against Assad and back in the jihadists against Assad and go ahead and slowly somehow figure out how to turn the policy around on, but no, it's been a year and a half and they're still stuck on Assad's got to go sooner or later.
Right.
Before peace breaks out, he's got to go still.
I'm no fan of Assad. He's a bastard, but I will add he's not as much of a bastard as some people say. I agree with Jonathan Marshall, my old friend Jonathan Marshall, that he did show signs of wanting to, keep the civil war from exploding by sitting down and talking to people. I think that gets totally overlooked and forgotten by the American media and certainly by the U.S. government. So he's terrible, but that doesn't mean he's as bad as everybody says. Same thing with Putin. So, and I don't want to be on Assad, Putin's, and Iran's side. In other words, I don't want to be on the Shiite side. I don't want to be on any side. Anything we do is going to make enemies, and that will come home to haunt us. I want to liquidate the empire. That's my position. Liquidate the empire.
Well, and again, that can be from a libertarian Richmondian point of view or even just an American imperial point of view, that it would make sense. It wouldn't be as contradictory and insane as the current policy, but it would still be counterproductive and bad policy even to align in a consistent and coherent way with Russia, Iran, Assad, and Hezbollah against the Islamic State. Because as you're saying, all these consequences, then will just flow from that. And it makes all their propaganda true that, look, it's the whole Roman Empire and the Eastern, Russian Empire too, allied with the Israeli Jews and the Iranian Shia Safavids all against us. And, what could possibly, go wrong with that? You know what I mean? I'm sure that'll work out. Once we have the combination between the Americans, the Russians, the Iranians, and the Kurds occupying Mosul, Fallujah, and Ramadi, and the Islamic State, temporarily beat down, after that, peace is going to break out, and it'll be great.
Sure. And the boys will be home by Christmas.
Right.
Nobody wants to admit that the exceptional nation can't do anything constructive in this situation. We have to face that. If that bruises our national ego, so be it. It doesn't bruise my ego. I'm happy to embrace that idea. The exceptional nation, however you want to define that, is powerless to do anything constructive. It's not powerless to do destructive things. Oh, it's perfectly capable of doing destructive things.
Right.
Infinitely so. But it can't do anything constructive. Everybody's got their own agenda. As I said, its own agenda. Israel, I left Israel out of that, but you quickly mentioned it. Thank you. Israel, as we know from their neocon brain trust of back in the 90s, were writing papers. Dan Sanchez has written about it. I've written about it. Writing papers about how destabilization is a good thing. They didn't want the secular pan-Arab powers like Nasser in power. They were secular. They were putting down the Muslim Brotherhood and people worse than that. But no, they were they couldn't have them because that was a threat to Israel's autonomy. So they had to knock those out. And we've been doing that. We've been knocking out, the U.S. has been knocking out secular Arab regimes. They did it in Iraq. They did it in Libya. They're in the process of trying to do it in Syria, without realizing that this is going to create opportunities for the people that we now worry about in Paris and Washington and, everywhere else. It's insane. And I use that word not in any technical sense. It's just insane to think the U.S. can go in there and do anything constructive. We got to wake up to the fact it cannot do it. It cannot do anything constructive. It's going to mess things up more. And it's hard to believe that things could get worse, but believe me, things could get worse.
Hey, let me ask you this real quick now. Are you worried at all about domestic backlash and bigotry against Muslims and that this is going to have very much of an effect?
I am somewhat worried about that. I mean, I still sort of have confidence that Muslim Americans who are here and, been here for a long time, probably won't. I mean, there's been some bad stuff since 9/11. I don't think that will get worse. I hope I'm not wrong about that. I'm concerned with the reaction to the refugee question. What is it? 30 governors, 35 governors, Rand Paul and Cruz wanting a religious test. And I'm very happy to see people at Reason and other places start talking about what people thought of Jewish refugees in the 30s, right? Saying, wait,
oh yeah, you saw that Jesse Walker piece?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Usual. It's excellent. Yes, fear that Jewish refugees were Nazi spies. I am concerned about that. I hope that doesn't get anywhere, and I'm going to be writing about that.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that was a great point, man. Good old Jesse Walker, dude. He's the best guy that got a reason for sure. All right, anyway, listen, I'm late. I got to go, but thanks very much for staying on and doing the show with me.
Always a pleasure.
All right, Sheldon, that's the great Sheldon Richman. He's at SheldonRichman.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Ken Silverstein. Writing at harpers.org on the blog there. Shaky Foundations. Welcome back, Ken. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. Hey, so great article. You know, I was thinking when I was reading this, these Clintons, they're just like the cops. They think they can get away with it, and they know they're right. And so they act like it. There's no law that applies to them, and not even shame. They're willing to just go ahead and do whatever the hell they want. So the news here is they have updated their tax returns, and they've been audited. So do tell, sir, please. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I agree with you exactly about, when there's no deterrent, when you know you have impunity and you can get away with anything, you continue to behave badly. It's just obvious. I mean, in the case of the death penalty, I don't believe that the death penalty deters crime or, people from killing each other, because people kill each other in the flash of a moment, or they plan it out for revenge. There are things that, you're always going to have people killing each other. And you can't stop it by saying, well, you'll die too, because some people just don't care. But you can deter crime by prosecuting people who commit most crimes. Like, you know, if we had prosecuted the Wall Street firms when they destroyed the global economy, if Obama had done that, they might not have started cheating again and gouging consumers again. In terms of the Clintons, they've been using, as I detail in this Harper's piece, they've been using their foundation. It's obvious. It's a money laundering vehicle. They take in money. I wrote specifically about a Canadian entity that is closely linked to it, headed by a criminal businessman. Let's just say an alleged criminal businessman. I don't want to offend anyone. And they, in Canada, donors to charities do not have to be disclosed to even to the Canadian government. I mean, you can, you know, in the United States, you don't, donors don't have to be disclosed to the public, but the IRS knows. In Canada, they have total privacy. So the Clintons have been taking in money via a Canadian nonprofit called the Clinton-Justra Economic Partnership and then funneling it into the United States. And there's no way to know the source of that income because they just list the donor to the Clinton Foundation as the Canadian entity. And I have been told by excellent sources that the Canadian entity has accepted dirty money from members of royal families in the Middle East and from officials who are with the dictatorship of Equatorial Guinea in West Africa and the former government of Jacob Zuma in South Africa. But they give in Canada because they can stay secret, and then the Canadian entity funnels it on to the United States. It's a money laundering vehicle, and it's also an influence peddling vehicle because donors to the Clinton Foundation get the attention or got the attention of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, and she very clearly paid close attention to what some of the donors to the Clinton Foundation wanted.
Mm-hmm. All right, so yeah, that's the direction I want to go now. Do you happen to remember, Ken, Bill Clinton's first day out of power, January 21st, 2001?
Well, didn't he pardon? No, he pardoned Rich on his last day in office.
Oh yeah, no, I'm talking about the next day.
When he was that? When he a few days, very soon after, I know he founded the Clinton Foundation after surrendering his law license because he lied about Monica Lewinsky.
Oh, that's something. Well, no, the thing I was thinking of, it must have been where he got the money to found his foundation in the first place. He gave a speech to Citigroup in Florida. Well, I'm 90% sure it was in Florida. It was the first thing he did, and they paid him $150,000 or something.
Oh,
good job, Bill.
Yeah, great job as president. Talk about it immediately, Cash.
Immediately. I mean, it was the next day, unless my brain is completely short-circuiting. I remember it from then going, wow. Boy, that guy, again, with the shamelessness, they just don't even figure anybody's watching, and mostly they're right. Just go ahead.
It's true, and, you know, he also, I mean, look, I don't care about the, you know, Clinton's sex conduct with Monica Lewinsky, I think was shameful, and Monica Lewinsky has written about that. But I think there was a, you know, Ken Starr was a, I've written before, a twisted zealot in pursuing Clinton over his private sexual misconduct. I mean, I don't believe that he should have been impeached or prosecuted or persecuted for what he did with Monica Lewinsky. It was bad in my view, but it's not an impeachable offense. I mean, so, but the thing is, like, he lied about it to the public and in depositions. I mean, he just lied, and then he later admitted he lied. He said he had to choose between, I can't remember, I don't have it in front of me, but he said something like he had to choose between lying or telling the truth no matter how painful. And so what he didn't say, but what is obvious is, I chose to lie. It was convenient for me to lie, so I just lied. And that tells you a lot about him. He doesn't even understand that when he says, I had a choice between lying or telling the truth, and I opted to lie, it says a lot about a person. When you acknowledge that and you don't even realize the confession you're making, that's what he was confessing to is, I will say anything and do anything if it serves my interest. So nothing he says can be trusted.
Oh, I mean, the guy lied every single day he was in power from 93 on, but yeah, and of course, in that case, too, he was the guy who signed the law making it a federal civil rights issue for somebody to sexually harass somebody else. So, I mean, not like that's anything anywhere near constitutional at that point, but taking that as making that a federal matter. But anyway, he's the one who did it, and then he wants to cry that he got sued under the very damn thing that he's the one who signed. And then he went and lied to a federal grand jury, which, to paraphrase his previous rape victim, Juanita Broderick, her son was a lawyer and told her, "Mom, you can't lie to the grand jury. You know, lying in a deposition and saying he didn't rape you is one thing, but you can't lie to Ken Starr and the federal grand jury. They'll bury you under the prison. You have to tell the truth." And so she did. But Bill Clinton said, "Oh, I can lie to him." And so, hell yeah, he should have been buried under the prison for that. For the President of the United States to obstruct and to perjure himself in a federal court on any issue, the fact that it was there would have been good enough for any of us to get buried under the prison for perjury.
Exactly.
Good enough for him.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Anyway, so tell us about these zillions of dollars of money laundering going on here. Because, well, and I still got a couple of minutes for this segment. Because you're talking about a criminal case here for a federal grand jury, Ken, it sounds like.
There's no question about it. And, I mean, you know, I write in the piece, you know, this may sound like Fox News conspiracy mongering. And this is the problem is that, you know, there's a lot of reporting on the right that is just pure partisan bullshit. And it's not backed up and sourced or, you know, you just can't trust it. But people then, you know, the Clintons then will say, oh, it's just a right-wing attack machine. And so then when you come along and you can actually document their wrongdoing, you sound like, unfortunately, because like the New York Times, even though the Times knows exactly what the Clintons are about, won't say it in black and white. They'll do it in the typical wishy-washy way that the mainstream, I hate that term, but it is, you know, the big mainstream outlets. They'll say like, well, you know, I mean, the Times did a piece recently on the Clinton Foundation that sort of buried its own conclusions in its typical even-handed way. You know, well, it looks bad, but gee, they do a lot of good charity work. No, they do very little charitable work. Very little of their money is spent on actual charity. And they use that then. You go through their foundation reports. It's really disgusting. I mean, you've got pictures of Chelsea Clinton, who, you know, who's never accomplished anything in her life but gotten rich off the family name and, you know, got a job at MSNBC at one point because, you know, daddy and mommy were powerful. I mean, Chelsea's kissing little African babies who had AIDS. Oh, it's so sweet and wonderful. What they don't say is the Clintons made a fortune off of AIDS. And you can read that in a column I wrote for the New York Observer a few weeks ago.
Awesome. That one I'm going to Google up. During the break, we're going to be right back with more from Ken Silverstein. Here he is writing at harpers.org on the blog there, Shaky Foundations, about the Clinton Foundation and their corruption and criminality. Right back after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Ken Silverstein from Harper's and the New York Observer here. Living off of AIDS. The Clintons, how'd you say, profiting off of AIDS, exploiting AIDS, some kind of fun thing like that. Ken, go ahead. What? I don't believe that the Butcher of Waco would profit off of AIDS. It couldn't be. Go ahead.
Well, the Clinton family always will surprise you. They actually have cashed in on AIDS. One of the things that their alleged charity, the Clinton Foundation, does is buy pharmaceutical drugs and provide them to poor people in Africa, Asia, and other parts of the so-called developing world. And the Clinton Foundation registered an entity to do this in Massachusetts. And it was run by Ira Magaziner, who was a veteran of the Clinton administration, the Bill Clinton administration, and who was a, you know, healthcare specialist. He ran it. He ran this nonprofit charitable entity to combat AIDS out of the same office where he ran his for-profit private consulting firm. And ultimately, to make a long story short, and you can go to my story at the New York Observer, the state of Massachusetts shut down the charity. They canceled its registration because of its shoddy accounting work and its failure to disclose what nonprofits are supposed to disclose and its breaking of the law. There's no question it broke the law.
That's funny. Hillary Care architect who's got the corrupt consultancy firm with the corrupt privatization, public-private partnership sort of thing going on there, and also is failing to carry out the so-called public end of it at all, which is helping the poor victims other than getting them kissed on the forehead by the angel Chelsea.
Exactly, exactly. And so you have this situation where they're receiving vast millions of dollars from multiple donors to buy AIDS drugs. And all I can say is it's complicated. We're on a radio program where we don't have a lot of time. Read my New York Observer column on Sidney Blumenthal from a few weeks ago. Just Google my name and Sidney Blumenthal, who in my new piece, which I urge you to read as well, that one at Harper's, I say that putting Sidney Blumenthal into a clean political system is like putting Typhoid Mary into an orphanage. You've got, when it comes to AIDS, they took in a lot of money, millions and millions and millions of dollars from donors to buy AIDS drugs and distribute them cheaply. And what they did instead was, you know, a little bit of that, and they profited a lot, a lot. They did buy, you know, it's hard to tell because they're accounting, and that's the whole point of my story today, is just how criminally corrupt their accounting procedures are. They bought some AIDS drugs. Who knows how much they spent? All I know is they spent a whole lot less on AIDS drugs than they took in from donors like the Bill and Melissa Gates Foundation. Big name donors gave them a lot of money to fight AIDS, and they profited from it. They did buy AIDS drugs. They distributed AIDS drugs. But all I can tell you is I wish I was in that business because I'd be really rich. If I operated the way the Clintons did, I would be very, very rich. I wouldn't have any scruples or morals, but I would have a lot of money. And that's what you have with the Clinton family, people who have no scruples or morals but have made a lot of money and who are deemed to be politically protected and hence not prosecuted to date by the IRS or Treasury. You know, they don't have their businesses shut down by the FBI. They don't suffer the indignities that the little people suffer.
Well, and Ken, look, I mean, we're not just talking about, you know, an ex-president. We're talking about the Secretary of State, the former Secretary of State from the current administration, who's currently the, you know, preordained supposedly candidate for president of the United States from one of the two major parties in this country. And what you're talking about in this article, and, you know, Harper's is not known for right-wing crankery. I'm pretty sure you're not just copying and pasting from Frank Gaffney here or anything like that. You're saying there's direct correlation showing causation between money from foreign governments into the Clinton charity that then, you know, basically you can see the pattern you say in the article where it's clear that what they're buying is access to her and access to speeches by the former president. But this is while she is the Secretary of State, and she's getting, you know, they're getting special access to the Secretary of State of the United States for this.
There's no question about it. It's, you know, as I lay it out, and, you know, go ahead. Clinton supporters, go read the piece and tell me where I went wrong. I'm waiting. You know, the Clinton Foundation declined to comment for the story. I told them more or less exactly what I was reporting. I've written two prior stories on them. I should also mention the third one. The first one was for Byline, which is a crowdsourcing site for investigative journalists. And if you like my work, I am broke because I shouldn't say that. I do not make a lot of money because I quit a job earlier this year at The Intercept. That paid me a lot of money, but I couldn't look myself in the mirror, so I now am able to write what I want to write. I don't get paid a lot of money, so I raise money through Byline. So if you go to, I think it's, let me double check. I think it's byline.com. You can, or just Google my, you know, byline in Ken Silverstein if you like my work. And I'm trying to raise money for my work because, you know, if you like the sort of reporting I do and that I'm talking about here, I need to get paid to keep doing it. So
that's cool, man. Yeah, you know, I got a thing like that at Patreon. It sounds like maybe byline is more along the lines. Patreon is supposed to be for artists and stuff, and I'm not that, but.
Well, whatever that, you know,
for what you're doing there. I'm for that byline. I'm sure it's byline.com. Well, hell, I'll Google it right now. Keep talking.
Well, in any case, you know, I've written three stories about it now, about the Clinton Foundation. Now they've all been very hard hitting. The Clinton Foundation has declined comment for all three. And the Canadian entity that I mentioned, which is, collects money in Canada anonymously and then funnels it on to the Clinton Foundation. It's a money laundering vehicle for the Clinton Foundation. That organization basically declined comment as well. They said, from now on, we're going to release the names of all of our donors, just like the Clinton Foundation. Oh, that's really encouraging. Let me just say that so far to date, they have released the names of 30 donors, and they have more than 1,000 whose names they haven't named. So now they're going to release the names of their donors? Well, that's really great, because I'm sure now, you know, Mary Had a Little Lamb and those sorts of people will be donating to this Canadian entity. But I want the names of the last 1,000 donors they kept secret. Who are they shielding? Who are they not disclosing to protect the Clinton Foundation? That's what I want to know. I don't care about the future donors. Let's talk about the past donors.
All right. Now, for 45 seconds, is there anything to worry about Bill Clinton's ties to this child rapist down in Florida?
Well, I am here actually to blow my own horn. So look at a piece I did, the first column I wrote for the New York Observer about Jeffrey Epstein. Again, Google my name, Ken Silverstein with Jeffrey Epstein. I have nothing in common with this guy. He's a creep. He's a great friend of Bill Clinton's, and that's another story. There are a lot of stories around the Clintons that should blow up and could blow up, and I hope they do before Hillary becomes president, because then we're all screwed.
All right, y'all, that is Ken Silverstein. He's writing at Observer.com, the New York Observer, Observer.com, and also at Harper's.org on the blog there. Thanks very much, Ken. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back, y'all, in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy stuff. Yeah, what a mess. I don't know. I really don't know where to begin. How about this? Read David Stockman today. He's the spotlight on antiwar.com. He's one of the best anti-war libertarian writers that we got. Former Reagan administration, treasury official type. I learned about him, from a Tom Woods interview that he was always anti-Vietnam War and stuff like that when he was young. Was never a warmonger. Was a peace monger all through the Reagan years and all that too. But he's really good, man. You know, the thing about him is, whenever he writes, he always writes the last 10 or 15 years of history for you and explains and hits all the right points. You know, first this happened, then the idiots did this, and then the stupid bastards did that, and then they did this, 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 and that, which leads us to the present thing, and now they want to do this, which is, of course, the dumbest, worst thing you could do. That's how all his articles are. And I don't really read all the economics ones, but certainly all his foreign policy articles are like that. And he's right about all of it. He's on point about everything. So, If I could write worth a damn, for I ever did, I actually ain't too bad at it when I do write, but if I did write, it would be a lot like what David Stockman writes, only not as good. So read him. It'll help make your brain smarter about the things that you know. Hey, tomorrow on the show, Marcy Wheeler's going to be here to talk about this one that's also running on antiwar.com today. Dot. I just mispronounced dot. How do you like that? Antiwar.com. Metadata surveillance didn't stop the Paris attacks. It's actually at Slate. I hope they paid her well. It's the best thing published at Slate in a long, long time. Three cheers for Marcy Wheeler. Metadata surveillance didn't stop the Paris attacks. Nothing that Snowden revealed and no consequence of Snowden's revelations had anything to do with what happened there. They had all of the expanded metadata, this and that, they could have possibly needed, and they still failed. Failed. There's no restrictions on what the NSA can do to people inside France. As far as violating their privacy, none. So, give us all a break. I'm trying to say, oh no, yeah, Snowden is the one who taught them that the NSA is interested in intercepting signals. Really, huh? I thought he was the guy who said, hey, all 7 billion people in the world, you know how we all know that they're very interested in intercepting signals and that they have carte blanche to intercept anything outside the United States of America? And the entire planet Earth said, yeah. And he said, they spy on the Americans like that too. That was the Snowden revelation. You damned liars. Oh yeah, no one had ever figured before 2013 that the NSA existed and, you know, did things with all them fancy computers of theirs. Anyway, that's the fun thing about lies is, you know, they just make it up. It doesn't matter if it even rings true. It doesn't matter if there's more than the slightest kernel of basis to believe. Just make up details to make the impossible things seem right. You know, why not? That's what you'd do if you had power. You know, BS everybody all day. All right. Well, I mean, if you wanted to keep it. And so, yeah, man, I was reading this morning about how in France they now have put, I believe, a couple of hundred people on house arrest. Maybe it was just 100, but still. On preemptive house arrest, not for doing anything, but for being radical Muslims that they're worried about. I don't know the details of the guys, whether they really are something to worry about or not. Gotta assume there's some innocence tied up with some real threats there, but then preemptive arrest, this, that kind of thing, that's problematic anyway. And anyway, they've got, you know, all kind of curfews and license to, you know, blanket license to come inside and look around. Really? In a Western democracy. And the president has declared, and I don't know the degree of the gun control laws there as they stand anyway, but I saw that he had declared the power, I don't know if he had invoked it or not, but he had declared that he had the power to seize all firearms inside the city of Paris. And so they're hopping straight on the Israeli-American model. When attacked, the government should pretend to be very, very afraid for the future of its people that it loves so much. And it'd take all their rights away in the name of keeping them safe. And damn, George W. Bush didn't go that far. Guess he coulda. Yeah, Dick Cheney had his dreams, you know. He wanted to send the army to arrest the Lackawanna Six. Why send the FBI? Let's send the army. Let's roll a tank down this street, this little suburb of Buffalo, New York. And put these guys in prison. Let George Tenet and the boys torture them for a while down at Rumsfeld's prison in South Carolina with Almari and Padilla.
Bush said, nah, you know, I don't want to roll a tank down streets in New York. Let's not do that. Let's just send the FBI. They're mean as hell enough, those guys. All right. Anyway, so that's the road that they're already going down there in France. And I want to point out that even in America, where regular folk have the right to bear arms, and that is somewhat a deterrent, certainly of crime, breaking in, entering crimes, and those kinds of things. And certainly could provide a means for someone to defend themselves in a situation where somebody's trying to execute civilians in numbers somewhere. It's not the solution. That's only, you know, your best defense is self-defense. You know, if it comes down to it. But we all recognize that even Americans, I don't think, would tolerate the amount of security it would take to still fail to secure us all. Let's think of all the soft targets there are in the United States of America. You guys have been up in an airplane and looked out the window, right? Let's think how easy it would be for any, say, 20 guys, like September 11th, who, if they wanted to, could hijack a gasoline truck and crash it into a crowd of people on a weekend event or something like that. Or start some forest fires. Or get a rifle in a position and snipe people in a crowd. Or whatever, man. You don't need imagination to figure out how to cause chaos if that's all you're trying to do. Hurt innocent civilians in order to provoke a reaction. There are as many soft targets in America as there are people in America. That's it. I mean, there's just no way. You don't want that many police. And who wants to live in a situation where you know how the French are feeling right now? I guess how a lot of New Yorkers and people in the Northeast felt after September 11th. Like, this really could happen to us at any time again. That in towns like Austin, Texas, where we're extremely far from any major obvious terrorist target. I guess the Capitol could be a symbolic target or something, you know, in Texas, but seems like there are much more symbolic ones to be hit. Could end up in a situation where we got to worry about stuff like that. And the only solution to it is the obvious one. And that is abandon intervention and stop creating new enemies. God help us, the FBI and Homeland Security, the only ones keeping these guys out of the country at this point.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. You can find all the archives at scotthorton.org, all except the last couple of weeks' worth, but I don't know. We're working on it. Hey, please look at this very important article at The Intercept. The Agony of Sada. U.S. and Saudi bombs target Yemen's ancient heritage. And it's a real tragedy, what she describes. You know, these buildings and civilizations that go back 3,000 years straight never had been conquered and erased and replaced in 3,000 years. Some of these buildings and houses, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old. Ancient, all kinds of ancient ruins and God knows what, completely blasted to hell by USA
and Saudi. And the thing is about the article, though, the real reason to read it is all the what she says about what's happening to the people there now. The tragedy of the ancient ruins being destroyed and all of that, I suspect, and I'll buy it, is, you know, a great lure to get people interested to look at it. What, the city was founded in the 4th century B.C. as the hub of the Minyan Kingdom of Maine? Okay. Anyway, tearing civilians, human beings, limb from limb, men, women, and children. 8 months and counting, almost 9 months now, of bombing Yemen. And this whole thing belongs to America. The Saudis could not do it without America doing it for them, helping them do it, running the whole thing, not just giving them the weapons and selling them more, resupplying them with bombs and bullets and more planes too, I guess. I don't know. But all the logistics and all the coordination, all the coordinates, all the midair refueling, the blockade out at sea, all of it. It's America's war against not even the Houthis, against the people of Yemen and the Houthis and for Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. Killing civilians by the thousands. So, please go read it. U.S. and Saudi bombs target Yemen's ancient heritage at The Intercept. Anyway. So, look. Here's the case against the war. My case against it. My partial case, as best as I can do in a short amount of time. Is, first of all, this is all George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Barack Obama's fault in the first place, see? Because at the end of the Cold War, Bush Sr. took us to war in the Middle East. Never mind, you know, back in Palestine this whole time since the end of World War II and their occupation of the Palestinians since 67. But the real insult to injury that got America targeted was the occupation of the Arabian Peninsula in order to bomb and blockade and murder the civilian population of Iraq beginning in August 1990. And when Clinton defeated George H.W. Bush, he kept his Middle East policy. Forget offshore balancing and sometimes arming Iraq and sometimes arming Iran to kill each other and this kind of horrible madness. How about this for worse? Dual containment. We'll stay in Saudi Arabia to contain Iran and Iraq both instead of using them against each other. And who cares, as David Wimser wrote in Coping with Crumbling States, if this provokes jihadists, whatever, whatever. We don't care about that. We got bigger fish to fry. The states we don't like. And so they stayed and they stayed and they stayed. And even though Dick Cheney himself admits that he had promised the king that the Americans would leave as soon as they got Iraq out of Kuwait. And they stayed and they stayed, and the terrorist war against the United States started then in 93, the first World Trade Center attack, and then you had the there was an embassy attack in Saudi by Al-Qaeda, not against us, but against the Saudi government there, I guess, somewhere in 95. I always get that one confused. Anyway, then there was the Khobar Towers in 96, the Africa embassies in 98, and the USS Cole, of course, in the year 2000, it was October, November 2000, the bombing of the USS Cole, the attempted LAX attack of the year 2000 that got thwarted by an alert border guard, and then the September 11th attacks. All of that, you know, perfectly understandable. They explained exactly what they were doing and why the whole time leading up to it. Had nothing to do with converting us or hating us for believing in the wrong God or anything or being free or having R-rated movies or women's rights or any of that crap at all. Nothing to do with it whatsoever. It's all about American foreign policy, every bit of it. Support for the Israelis over the Palestinians and the Lebanese and support for the dictatorships of the region and the occupation of the Arabian Peninsula. And then George Bush exploited the September 11th attack. Might as well have done it himself. He exploited the damn thing so much to play right into the enemy's hands, build up Al-Qaeda in Iraq out of nothing. And then when they went home, Obama took their side in Libya and Syria. And that's what led to the rise of the Islamic State. Also, of course, that Bush had fought for the Shia in Iraq and the most Iranian-backed factions of those, the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party, who wanted to break up Iraq, who didn't want to rule Sunnistan. They just wanted from Baghdad down to Kuwait, and George W. Bush gave it to them. That's what that whole war was for. And so, you know, Maliki and his predecessors and successors have no reason whatsoever to deal with the Sunni, because they can fling suicide bombers at Baghdad all day, but they can't roust the Shia out of power now. Way too late for that. Ship sail, that kind of thing. So that's helped create the Islamic State there in western Iraq. And then, of course, the war in Syria, supported by America, NATO, and the GCC allies for the last 4.5 years, is what has led to the rise of the Islamic State. And now these same people, the Clintons and Bushes, literally, and everyone, the very same think tankers and media liars and talking heads against them, are now saying that they're the ones who are going to solve this Islamic State problem for us. And yet, but without putting 100,000 troops on the ground, which only created them in the first place, and obviously leads to a dead end, eventual withdrawal, and the re-rise of the same damn problem again. And so, but they say they're going to do it. Not the ground troops, but they're going to defeat the Islamic State. And yet, every possible avenue that they could take to defeat the Islamic State is self-refuting and or counterproductive and impossible. The Saudis and the Jordanians and America's Sunni sock puppet regimes, they're behind, or not so much Jordan. Well, yeah, Jordan too. They let the CIA operate out of there anyway. These are the guys who backed the al-Nusra Front, Ahrar al-Sham, and even the Islamic State this whole time. The Saudi army that's now, that we're helping bomb Yemen right now, is going to invade western Iraq, the Anbar province, liberate Fallujah, Mosul, Ramadi. Yeah, right. Or we could take the Ayatollah's side, like George W. Bush did, and contra Ronald Reagan, and import the Iranian Revolution and their military all the way into Sunnistan, into full-scale war. They're not going to do that anyway. They have no interest in doing that. And even if America paid for it all and provided all the air cover in the world, they're not going to do it. But imagine if they did somehow. You could convince the Iranians to send their army in to rouse the Islamic State out of their three major cities in western Iraq. Then what? Yeah, right, exactly. Continuous war forever. As the entire civilian population of Sunnistan is driven straight in the arms of the Islamic State. Same thing for the Kurds. The Kurds aren't from Mosul. That ain't their town. And even when they were there for a very short time in 2003, at the start of Iraq War II, they created enemies for themselves in Mosul immediately and then withdrew and said, forget trying to rule Mosul. That's too far out from Kirkuk. We're going to focus on kicking the Arabs out of Kirkuk and taking that as solidly Kurdish territory and forget Mosul. And so again, even backed by the Americans and all the power of the world, and even if we could convince them to do it, to conscript every fighting aged male Kurd to go and liberate Mosul and whatever, what are they going to do? Occupy them forever? They're going to have unending war and eventually have to retreat again anyway. And then if they would, what's supposed to be the reaction of the Turks to that? Our allies, the Turks, to our empowering of the Kurdish Peshmerga, the PKK, the YPG, etc., at Turkish expense. No chance. And what are the Israelis going to do when the American, or if the Americans, were to back Hezbollah and Assad's Shiite Baathist army, backed by the Russians, against the Islamic State? First of all, politically, that ain't going to work because the Israeli veto. And secondly, we're still playing right in the Islamic State's hands, acting out their script of the Romans and the Israelis and the, the West and even the Russians allied with the Shia against them, whatever, and make them more powerful. Every bit of it, contrary, self-refuting, counterproductive, can't work. So try quitting.